Best Moments episode of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudelli sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudelli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. Talk to us about how you determine your risk per trade.
Okay, this is a common question. It's a really important one. You know, at the end of the day, it's how you manage risk that makes or trades you as makes or breaks you as a trader, I believe. How do you determine risk? So there are a lot of factors that go into that. We'll start, you know, from the macro perspective. What is your risk tolerance as a trader? What's my risk tolerance? Most people identify themselves as very risk averse, meaning they're very risk shy. So you have to have, because this is a leveraged product, you have to have a high tolerance for risk to trade futures, because there's a significant amount of risk. That's why it's not suitable for everybody. But so you have to kind of know yourself coming in. The second thing is the money you're trading your money? Is it somebody else's money, which I've traded in the past, and it puts a lot more pressure? And also, how much money is there? You know, in a perfect world, we don't want to risk more than maybe 1% per trade, 1% of your account value per trade. But to a lot of people, 1% isn't even a point in the S&Ps or the 10 years or whatever. It's very difficult to judge that. So for me personally, I look at the risk of ruin equation. This is all like Van Tharp type stuff where we're really looking at, if I got into a bad streak, say 12 trades in a row that didn't work, how much does that hamper my ability to continue to take the 13th trade? Not only financially, but also emotionally. I'm seeing that I'm just getting run over. Everything I'm doing, I feel like I'm doing everything right, but I'm getting run over. What is it going to take for me to take that 13th trade? So you want to keep that to a minimum. The more you risk, the more one risks per trade, the higher the risk of ruin becomes. We want to keep that to about 1%. A rule of thumb that I like to use is the exchange margin that's put out by the CME, for example, is not some number that some person just kind of says, okay, let's make the initial margin on EES $6,600. They don't just pull that out of a hat. That number is a statistical number. It's based on how far one contract can go before settlement on a three sigma basis or something like that. So use that number. So, you know, you want to be really risk aware, and you have a pretty substantial account, trade one contract per margin requirement, per initial margin requirement, 6,600 in EES and so on. You can look those up on the CME site. Worst case, I think for most traders, is trading one contract for half of the margin. So don't trade more than one contract in EES for every $3,300 you have in an account in terms of the current margin requirement. Don't go below that. I believe that it's very imprudent to drop to $500 margins or anything like that. I think those should be regulated out. They should not be permitted at all. So that's one way to kind of keep yourself from really blowing up. The best way to deal with risk is to be well-funded and then to create a very clear outline of what your risk plan is. It's something you kind of want to have in front of you in large font. Hey, you know, two trades, three trades in a row, and I have to stop for the day. You know, three losing days in a row, I'm done for the week, that sort of stuff. You need to have some parameters. But determining risk is a factor of account size, risk tolerance, time frame. You know, if I was trading like Anthony here, who's more of a, you're more of a swing guy, right? You're looking at multiple days.
No, I don't trade multiple days. I trade intraday, but for me, I pick one direction after the first hour and I trade actively in that direction.
Got it.
So that's more of how I trade these days.
Yeah. So for your time frame, you might. I think the Ultra Bond is your favorite product.
Yeah, the 10-year Ultra is my favorite right now.
Yeah, I mean, for your product, you might have a huge stop that's intolerable for me. So your time frame is bigger than mine, whereas I might have a time frame that is so small that I can. You know, I can afford a 4-point stop or contract or something like that. So the time frame really is important in terms of determining risk, in my opinion.
I think we touched base a little bit on this today, is comparing weather patterns or actually temperature variance to technical patterns. Talk to us about that.
Well, it's really interesting. Let me attack that issue from how I sort of got to that. And it's the suddenness of with how markets move, as to, it seems to me that when you go into a bear market, and now this is something I'm sort of ad-libbing here, so I'm thinking it through as we speak. But at solar maximums, I'm thinking 1980 and 1982, when we go into bear markets at solar maximums, it seems to me that the market kind of rolls over. Conversely, at solar minimums, when we've got this issue with the sun going quiet and sudden onset of winter, we get these very scary drops seemingly out of nowhere. This past fall was kind of an example of that the markets really fell out of bed precisely at the time that far below normal temperatures came in. I'll mention this. What caught my attention years ago was the famous video speech of Charlie Munger talking before the Harvard Business School or Law School. Now, Charlie Munger is really fascinating. Before he went to Harvard Law School, a lot of people might not know this, is that he was an Air Force meteorologist. And he was a thermodynamics major at Caltech, and he dropped out to go into the Air Force. But he was a meteorologist. And he said in the middle of that speech, it was one line, he said, "Everything is resolvable in the Pascal triangle." And I went, "What?" Now that's interesting. And what he was basically saying is, it's not just the Pascal triangle, but it's something called the Sierpinski triangle. And it is what happens in nature, and when you have temperature variance, is that this gets into Tesla's work too, by the way, is that we're really an electromagnetic system. We are an electromagnetic system as people and a biosphere, and also the physical properties of an iron core planet. And that means that we have alternating current that flip-flops back and forth. People are looking constantly, I believe, for linear progressions. They're looking for exit and entry points based on a logical progression. And key reversals that happen in meteorology happen with great suddenness, seemingly out of nowhere. And they seem to not necessarily arrive from point A to point B, but they emerge out of nowhere right over us. And I notice that there's a similarity between how that happens in markets and how that happens in meteorology. For example, the flip to cold from mild in December is something that's playing out as a flip-flop. It's a bang-bang. It's like a bathtub slosh. And it plays in, instinctively and intuitively into that notion of how an alternating current system works. And I think that that's what Charlie Munger was referencing when you examine the properties of the Pascal or the Sierpinski triangle. As you, if you color code it and you progress through it, the geometry of the Pascal triangle inverts. And so you apply that into his logic of the value approach of Berkshire Hathaway when Charlie Munger says, invert, always invert. I believe that human sentiment with respect to the markets flip-flops in a single, in a similar manner, and it has to do with how our brain symmetry works as a, as part of this alternating current system. That it's back and forth. We assess risk, left brain, right brain. It's a tug of war between right and left brain, the flip-flop, and it makes us feel insane because it's very confusing until we get to understand how we can resonate with how the entire system around us is working and get in rhythm with it. And with respect to our own chatter and this sort of dissonance that goes on between right and left brain, if we can separate ourselves from our own propensity towards fear and greed and act in a contrary manner to our own base instincts of how our brains are responding to what's going on around us, we put ourselves in a minority superior position.
It doesn't sound to me like you had any mentors in the industry, did you?
No, not a single one.
So what were the things that you did to learn about the business? Did it come from Twitter? I know that you're obviously on there. Did you meet people on there? I mean, how did you go about learning about trading?
So I learned about trading by losing. It was that simple. I didn't have anyone tell me that what I'm doing is right, what I'm doing is wrong. I learned by losing capital. There's no arguing with that. You lost money at the end of the day. You lost money. Something's got to be wrong. It's not subjective. It's, you can't blame it on anything else. That's just the bottom line. So I learned a lot by losing. I still do. I still do. And I'm pretty hard on myself because I always say every trade, if it's profitable, I kind of disregard it, but I really, really harp on the losing ones. And I always revisit those because the most lessons you can learn are from your losers. I actually say I never really even learned anything from a profitable trade, which is kind of extreme to say. And I know that, of course, that's not exactly what I mean, but in a rough sense and overall, to years of investing, I've learned very little from profitable trades. I always say it could have been luck. You really don't know. But those losses, they're on you. You have to take ownership of them. And you can revisit them and ask yourself, what went wrong? Look at the charts. Dive into the fundamentals. There's got to be something. Not every time. You know, bad luck is on our side a lot. Not a lot, but it's there. It presents itself. There's no denying that, but I'll always visit my losers because that's where I've learned.
Obviously, you know, this is Futures Radio Show. So majority of my listeners are traders and investors. So we all want to know how what you're doing is going to impact our industry. If you could, please just dumb it down a little bit for us and just explain what it is that you guys are doing and how that will impact the financial industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really easy to get very highfalutin and lost in some of the jargon of the industry. What we do, I think where the talk is around all this stuff and where the reality is are very different places. So in reality, the primary things we're doing are actually primarily not related to blockchain, but have to do with compliance and due diligence. And so, for example, people make an account on our website, it's helium.atomiccapital.io is our actual application. And at the get-go, you're just going through like an AML KYC check and accreditation check just to make sure that you're eligible to make an investment of any kind, as you would for any kind of private placement, Reg D or Reg S kind of investment. And then once people have gone through that process, they can view various offering documents, a lot like, I'm hesitant to be, try to dissociate from like equity crowdfunding, but similar to a platform like that, where it's just providing with relevant information and presenting it in a clear way so that you can make an assessment about the attractiveness of a investment vehicle. And then if somebody does decide to invest, they sign a, you know, an embedded DocuSign contract on our platform. But that contract says, you know, this token was referred to, or digital security, is going to represent some kind of real security instrument. So that could be equity or debt type instruments or even derivative products. So essentially, it's just a legal and electronic wrapper around a traditional security that then takes on unique features that a blockchain enables. Primarily, people emphasize the possibility of greater liquidity on illiquid assets, as well as easier compliance with whatever securities regulations law is out there, and that can be automated in some ways via code. And then I think additionally, just sort of being able to enforce rules, it's kind of similar to what I was just saying, but just kind of ease and lower cost of administrating a security ongoing.
Thanks, but I'd like to dig a little bit deeper on explaining to everybody what it is that you guys do and how it is impacting our industry. I know because of compliance, you probably can't give us a customer or client's name, but can you give us a real life example of what you're doing and how it is impacting the financial industry?
So I think because of it, like nascency of the industry, there's not many things that really take on a lot of the benefits people espouse. So to be specific, you know, I've worked on projects related to tokenizing LP interests in a VC fund. So instead of giving money to some guy and he goes and buys startups and you wait 7 years, 10 years to get your money back, hopefully, instead you invested at, you know, the Reg D kind of offering, which has typically a 1 year lockup period. But then after that 1 year lockup period, I could actually potentially trade that or do a peer to peer type trade, or there are actually secondary markets that are registered with the SEC that have ATS licenses. Some of the prominent ones are Open Finance, T0, Templum here in the United States, that allow for like order matching book trading of, you know, LP interest in a VC fund. So suddenly I can get out after a year or maybe 3 years, and you're also getting real-time pricing on the perceived value of that security as well.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. I want to talk about the execution side of things coming from you as a macro trader. Can you share with us a recent example of a crude oil trade that you studied on the macro side, then you what you saw on the technical side, and then walk us through how you get into the trade, but also how you determine a stop, where you would be wrong on the trade? Because I'm always interested to see how someone who has a macro point of view decides when they're wrong, right? Because the market, they may be right on the macro side of things, but the market might be proving them wrong. So I want to know how you would be proved wrong, and then also how you would determine your targets, where you think the market could go.
Yeah, sizing macro trades is a fascinating topic. Kyle Bass talks about that quite a bit. And the way that I do it is I always start with, we can all be wrong. How much am I willing to lose in either dollars or basis points, you know, percent of portfolio, however you want to express it? How much am I willing to lose when I end up being proven wrong? And I really try to get my head around when that happens, not if that happens. And it's just in terms of managing risk, you don't ever want to get yourself into the, oh, but I know it's never going to happen. Because I'm sure I'm right. You can't think that way because you get killed. You can always be wrong. So when I'm proven wrong, what's the number that I can be satisfied with and say, hey, I had so much conviction about that trade, I don't mind losing X number of dollars or X percent of my portfolio for having been proven wrong. And then once I've got that number, I write that down, I set it aside. I don't do the math to figure out, you know, what the stop level has to be, but I look at the chart and I say, what's the price that this thing has to hit on the chart where it doesn't add up anymore. If it gets to this level on the chart, that means I'm wrong. And once I know those two numbers, I know where the stop is, which is where I'm wrong, not where I've run out of money to lose, but where I'm wrong on the chart. And I know how much money I need, I'm willing to lose, and I divide them and I end up with the position size. That's the way that I size positions. And what that means is you end up sometimes with fairly small positions, because it really feels like, look, if I've nailed this right on the technicals, you know, we're not going to go to new all-time highs on the stock market. If we get to 29.50 again and I short that, well, I can use pretty big size there because I know as soon as we get to new all-time highs that I was wrong, and that's my stop. And okay, whereas if I'm dealing with something like spreads on crude oil futures, where little disruptions can really put big wrinkles in them. If you are trading spreads in crude oil futures and you have something like last year in around Thanksgiving, we had a minor spill in the Keystone pipeline. It was only about 5,000 barrels that spilled. But for about a day or so, the news was very uncertain. It wasn't really clear. It was some kind of spill, and they were trying to get good data on how big it was, and nobody was sure. And of course, markets hate any kind of uncertainty. You know, it could be anything. We don't know how big the spill is. Oh my God. And there was an absolute panic blowout in crude oil spreads around those delivery months that I happened to be actively trading. And, you know, I got stopped out of that position. It turned out to be nothing. It was just a 5,000 barrel spill, and all of the dislocation that occurred in the spreads ended up coming back out. But it was still enough to trip me out of a position. And so you've got, when you trade based on macro themes that are big picture stuff, you've got to realize that little picture stuff can screw up your trade. This was a trade that was motivated by an understanding of how the front end of the WTI strip, the spreads are affected by different fundamentals than what affects them 2 years out. At the front of the strip, it's really about how much inventory is physically in the tank in Cushing, Oklahoma. When you're looking a year or two out, then the shape of the term structure is entirely about future expectations of tightening or easing of supply-demand dynamics between markets. So there's a transition point about 4 to 6 months out on the strip where the factors that are affecting those spreads changes, and you can often get a reversal in the pattern of the term structure. If you're betting on that big picture playing out over the course of a year where you start out by shorting spreads that are a year out on the curve, figuring that you're going to short them in backwardation and you're going to end up covering those shorts in contango at the front of the strip, and then all of a sudden there's a pipeline spill, that can create massive backwardation, which if you understand it, it's a fantastic opportunity to double your size if you really understand it. But if you don't understand what's going on, you're going to get stopped out there because all of the sudden this spread you thought should get smaller is getting bigger, dramatically bigger. Well, why is it getting bigger? It's getting bigger because the pipeline sprung a leak. How big is the leak? How long is it going to take them to fix it? And one of the problems that it results in, especially for independent traders, is you don't have as good of information as the really big trading desks. The guys at VTOL that are, you know, trading crude oil have every imaginable information source under the sun. They can afford to pay for all of it. And if you're, following hashtag OOTT on Twitter, and maybe you've got a subscription service to one of the entry-level crude oil data services, but you don't have all the expensive stuff, you're really at a disadvantage, and you've got to think about what kind of trades you want to put on. So it starts from understanding what you expect to have happen, but then you've got to figure out what are the things that can go wrong. and there are things outside of your control, are you going to use that opportunity and just accept the stop out? Do you want to go for maybe a tighter stop and use that opportunity when you get stopped out to look to re-enter at a much wider spread? You can do that. You know, certainly there have been times in my experience where I've done that. I've been stopped out because the spreads were blowing up. I thought they were going to get smaller. Why are they blowing up? Because we had wildfires in Canada and the shutdown of the Keystone Pipeline for maintenance and so forth. And I looked at the whole situation. I said, you know, this is horrible, but it's going to get better. And these spreads now are at way beyond historical norms. They're still 4 or 5 months from expiry. I'm going to short them now that they've blown out. And sure enough, that was a profitable trade. I ended up more than double making back what I lost when I got stopped out of the trade in the other direction. So really understanding what's driving this stuff is important. And I think that, you know, it's something that there's a different discipline that I don't subscribe to, just because it doesn't suit my personality. A lot of traders would say, don't try to understand any of that. Just look at the chart. You know, when you see something start to trend in the opposite direction than you expect, get out. Don't try to understand it. Well, if you don't try to understand it, that's fine, but you don't know why you're getting out. I need to understand it. I would go crazy just getting stopped out of trades, having no idea what went wrong. I need to understand what the driver is. Okay, the reason that I just got stopped out of my spread trade is because there was a spill on the Keystone Pipeline. So what's going on? How long is it going to take to fix it? What do I expect the market to do after this problem has been resolved? To me, I don't know. I guess it's just a personality thing. I couldn't do trading without caring about and trying to analyze my trades that went wrong and figure out what caused them to go wrong. I guess a lot of other guys just, you know, once you hit the stop, you forget about it, you move on to the next trade. I don't do that because I can't. I'm not emotionally capable of that. And I'd say the most important single lesson that I've learned about trading is to recognize that all of us are emotionally incapable of something. Figure out what it is that you personally are emotionally incapable of. Stop denying that you're incapable of it and make adjustments accordingly. And I know in my case, I have to understand how things work. It's just how my personality is wired. And that limits me. I can't engage in certain trading strategies that work for other people because they don't care. They don't need to know how things work and why things work. I have to know that. It's just how my personality is wired.
With all of the knowledge on all the different things that we talk, how do you and then go about building?
The way we look at it is for RSL and then we have a dual strategy where there's no cross variance with anything else. We probably have some historical event that we do, and then we trade optimally. Sometimes our strategies involve cross-sectional point, compile all these all together, taking them all into account, portfolio to put on two different types of strategies. Break it up so that whether you're doing a cross-sectional strategy, because there are alternative data sets in the Eagle Alpha says there's going to be 2 or 3 years. We actually have people looking at them, right? About 50 analysts on Wall Street. So we're going through a revolution data and AI right now. Remarkable. Know that we can't do it all. They can do it all. And created our platform to make it so the 25 data scientists in the world and get them to help us out of sifting through all this data to trigger out what trades to put on.
biggest macro theme you see happening in 2019?
I think the key question for 2019 is, when's the Fed going to reverse course and begin growing their balance sheet like the BOJ? Is that late 2019? Is it early 2020? Is it later than that? I don't think it is. Could it be earlier than late 2019? I think it could be, depending on how economic trends play out. There are few people paying attention to what's going on in sovereign debt, because you just have never had to think about it. It kind of ties back to the example I used before. You know, everybody that, you know, we're in a global sovereign debt bubble. You've got all this debt yielding near 5,000-year lows that is full faith and credit of a bunch of governments that, if you look at the numbers, they're broke. They're all broke, and particularly in the West, but, you know, depending on how you allocate it, others as well. And no one's thinking about it, because it's just, well, that's tomorrow. That's tomorrow. That's tomorrow. And it's been tomorrow for our entire lives, but tomorrow's becoming today. And how fast tomorrow becomes today will depend on how quickly the global economy slows. If there's a crisis anywhere in the world, that will speed this up. And the people that traded through the last global sovereign debt bubble, bursting, were born between 1880 and 1900. And so they're all dead. So they're not around to kind of say, hey, when you see this, you know, this means this is going to happen, that's going to happen. But in the last global sovereign debt bubble, the way it worked out was the sovereign debt of the United States, the United Kingdom, Japan, Russia, Germany, France. So basically all the major powers of the day fell on a real basis, adjusted for currency, by 60 to 100% in under 12 years. And that's a kind of, like, you know, the kind of thing that is, and it's happened over and over and over, but it's a long cycle. But we're at that point of the long cycle. And so to me, when you understand the severity of what we're marching towards, I then pull that back to, what does that mean for Fed policy? And to me, if the Fed has an ounce of understanding of history, et cetera, they understand they're walking around with a lit match in a giant factory of nitroglycerin. And do they really want to keep that match lit for a little too long? And my bet is they will consistently say no, for good cause. And so to me, to answer your question directly, I really think the story of 2019 is going to be, the shift from, Powell's the man, he's the Terminator, he's going to kill everybody and take the dollar to the moon, to, boy, Powell's like Yellen, who's like Green, who's like Bernanke, who's like Greenspan, so that, to me, I think is a big theme we're setting up for, and one we're watching in our research for sure.
How do you determine a stop? Are you working a hard stop, or something you have to change for you to get out? And also, along with that, is how are you determining how much you're going to risk per trade? Is every trade that you're putting on the same contract size? Is it the same risk amount? How does that all work?
I don't use hard stops. And I couldn't use hard stops when I was trading much larger sizes as a CTA and so forth. I mean, you can't sit there and put a stop on 300 coffee futures, So if it looks like the trade's not working, you just try and get smaller, put it that way. I mean, pretty darn well if it's working or it's not working. I mean, anybody's stupid if they know their trade's not working, and they don't do something about it. Okay. you're not going to last very long. So you should have a good idea in your head as to what the market should be doing. Why did you make that trade? What is the play? Is the play to go up and test the previous day's high? Is it getting there in a slow motion or a fast motion? What are you playing for? I think that's the very first question that you have to ask. Now, in terms of setting targets, I really don't set targets, but I'm watching it in relationship to a reference point. As I just mentioned, I'm watching it. Can we go up and test the previous day's high? This morning we opened up. Can we go up and test the Globex high? Of course, we should have tested yesterday's high, or rather, Friday's high, because of the momentum. So you got pretty good odds there. So that gives you your initial bias. So I have my initial bias. The chart confirms it. The tape confirms it. Is there volume there? Well, we're probably going to get a little bit more, than I'm looking for. So when you know, when there's a breakout trade, like let's say we've been consolidating for 3 days, and let's say in terms of market profile concepts, and I mentioned that because so many people use that nowadays, you know, you can look at the fact that there's a volume node, and that just simply means that the market has come into balance. You know, it's come into an equilibrium point. And you could see that, like, for example, on the Russell futures 3 days ago, you know, we had 3 days of price bar overlap. The market was in balance. It had a big perfect equilibrium node. So the first day out of something like that, I don't put any targets on, because I don't know if it's going to give a little, and I don't know if it's going to give a lot. And if it does give a lot, I don't want to chop off my nose to spite my face, because that's where the real money is made. Maybe 2 days a month, you know, are making up 80% of my month. You know, it's a very, very uneven distribution of, you know, how these profits or losses fall. You know, it's not a standard bell-shaped curve type of thing. You know, you've got like really fat tails in the market. I think people underestimate just how fat those tails are. And so I want those tails to work in my favor when I've got a good trade on, and I don't want to exit too soon. So usually what I'll do, if I know I've caught a strong trend day, and I guess that would be something where experience would just help you understand, you know, the market internals are a particular way, and the volume's a particular way, and the tape's acting a particular way. What I'll do is I'll have a core position on, and then I will try to scalp in the direction of the move as well. So I have a core position on, and if there's a little continuation pattern or a little pause, I'll enter and then, you know, flip that out. So I never trade against my position. I never lift my position and try to reestablish it at a better price, you know, because the risk is just too great that I won't get it on again. You know, that's what happens with the very best days. And I think that that's what I was trying to explain when I was talking about the experience factor is what really is going to make you into a professional, is understanding what those really best days look like and where you need to be discriminating on that, you know, and increase your leverage and know how to hold it. You know, if it's too easy to take profits, obviously you want to be staying with that market, you know.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.